All rise. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session.
Okay. So, good morning, everyone. In these unique circumstances, thank you for your willingness to participate in our virtual court. And Judge Hawkins and I would like to thank Judge Rustani from the Court of International Trade, who's sitting with us on assignment for a while. Thank you, Judge Rustani.
Welcome.
Okay, we only have two cases for argument this morning. We're going to hear Miracle versus Hobbs first. When we finish with the argument in Miracle, we'll take a short 5-minute recess so that the audio visual crew can make sure we have a proper connection with the next case. So, Miracle versus Hobbs. Go ahead, counsel.
Good morning, Judge Paez, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Frost, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Just like the robocall law in victory processing, the strikeout law imposes an additional hurdle to political speech based on its content, in the process disproportionately disadvantaging campaigns with less resources. The state's interest in subpoena compliance does not allow it to mandate harsher or different penalties related to a recipient's engagement in a specific kind of speech. Thus, when this court considered an Arizona law that imposed special penalties on soliciting day laborers from stopped cars that impede traffic, the court said that of course Arizona may prohibit people from blocking traffic, but it may not, consistent with the First Amendment, use a content-based law to target individuals for harsher or more lenient punishment because of the message they convey.
Counsel, how is this case different than the Ninth Circuit's case in Wynn versus Ripple, involving a Washington statute that required the disclosure of the names and addresses of paid circulators?
Well, Your Honor, in that case, first of all, in that case, the court found that it was unconstitutional. I think in this case, you have an even stronger, you go straight to, it's a content-based claim in this case. Wynn versus Ripple didn't actually raise a content-based claim. Had they done so, then I think that's potentially the conversation they would have been having. I think, I want to make sure I understand the question correctly. In the way that it's different is that this is a direct regulation on the speaker, and it is the additional punishment, the penalty that is threatened, is connected directly to the communicative conduct which they engage. So the best way to think of this is, frankly, you could hire the same person to solicit signatures for initiative petitions or to solicit signatures for nomination petitions. And the only difference is the first person is threatened with the penalty. They could be talking to the same voter. Everything else is the same because of the communicative content they're involved in. And I think what this court said in Arizona Right to Life, what this court said in Pest Committee, when you have this content-based discrimination, then it doesn't matter whether you think of it as Anderson Burdick or going straight to strict scrutiny. You end up in the same place. This case is also
a question about the state of Ninth Circuit law at this point. We had the, I think it was the Preet case, that basically used an older way of looking at content-based speech. But nonetheless, that is looks to be the Ninth Circuit law unless the Supreme Court has overruled it. I'm not sure that, so my question is the sign case close enough to this to actually dispense with the Ninth Circuit ruling on this? Are we still bound by the Ninth Circuit case Preet? That's my question.
So I think there's a couple things about Preet. And I think the very first one you put your finger on in the question itself, which is the footnote the state relies on in Preet, makes the same mistake that this panel made in Reed in talking about when there is a content-based restriction. Right? It went straight to purpose, which Judge Hawkins, in response to your question, one of the other things I wanted to point out is in this case, we actually have a concession from the Secretary of State that the purpose of the law was also to infringe upon speech, which you didn't have in Wynn. So, Judge Rustani, going back to Preet, to the footnote in Preet, it goes straight to purpose. And what Reed says, and what Reed said, the Ninth Circuit, frankly, did wrong in the decision below in that case, was exactly that. It went straight to purpose. You don't even get there if you look at the content, the face of the content. Preet seemed to misunderstand this and said, look, we don't have any evidence here that the legislature was trying to target this kind of speech to hinder it in any kind of way. That's actually another way that I think Preet is different, and frankly, I think if you felt you could still reconcile Preet with this case, because here you have admissions that, in fact, what the legislature was trying to do was target this kind of speech. So even under Preet's, I think, mistaken application of the law, which doesn't survive Reed, that you go straight to purpose.
Is this a facial challenge or an as-applied challenge?
It's a facial challenge, Your Honor. It's a facial challenge.
We treat your motion for a preliminary injunction as if it were filed at the onset of the litigation.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the question.
There's no difference between, for the purpose of considering the statute and its constitutionality, between a motion for preliminary injunction filed right out of the box at the start of litigation as opposed to when you filed it now. It's a strict facial challenge.
We filed the motion for a preliminary injunction 1 week after we filed the complaint. So we filed it pretty much immediately right out of the box. But I don't think it matters. I think the reality is, you know, even if we'd waited longer, there's certainly no case law that said we waited too long. And even if we'd waited longer, here we are talking about a facial-based claim that directly penalizes speech for engaging in a particular kind of communicative conduct. And I submit that is so dangerous for the First Amendment. I think it's helpful to step back and think about why is it that facial challenges are treated so differently. And I think this actually also speaks to the district court's view of this as a situation where maybe some Arizona state judges didn't manage the courtroom, just mismanaged the courtroom well. The reason we treat content-based claims so different is because of the very threat that the government either might be using it in order to put its thumb on the scale against a certain kind of speech, or that even if that's not their intention now, some bad actor in the future might do that.
Paid circulators are required to register with the Secretary of State of Arizona?
Correct, Your Honor.
You have a problem with that?
Not at all, Your Honor.
And they now sign a affidavit, I think, agreeing to the jurisdiction of the courts of Arizona?
Correct, Your Honor.
Do you have any problem with that?
No, Your Honor. And there's no indication that any of...
Your complaint is that the statute treats candidate petitions different from initiative petitions, correct?
Correct. But paid circulators of candidate petitions and out-of-state circulators of candidate petitions also do both of those things. They also register and they submit to the jurisdiction of the court. And this is actually one of the reasons Arizona has never been able to explain why those generally applicable laws that themselves don't penalize a certain kind of speech more, don't impose an additional penalty on initiative speech, are not enough in order to serve their interest of fraud and subpoena compliance. And that is crucial. I want to be perfectly clear. The injunction we're asking for would not take away from the courts of Arizona the ability to strike signatures even because a circulator doesn't show up. It would restore their discretion to make the choice based on what's in front of them and what is appropriate given the evidence in front of them and given what they see happening in their courtroom, which is exactly what they do, by the way, for volunteer circulators of even initiative petition and for all circulators of nomination petition. And in those cases, they do sometimes strike signatures when people don't show up. They just don't have to. And I think that what, you know, one of the real ills of this law, and it's one of the reasons you see why it chills speech long before action challenges, is it creates this incentive to subpoena people you would never, ever subpoena.
Let me ask you one question that bothered me when I read the district court's order. When she gets to the goes to the analysis, at one point she the district court recognizes that there's a content-based claim, but says, I really can't decide it now. It's there, but there is some might be some problem here on content because of the focus on the initiative circulators. But she says, this it's not teed up properly yet. And she did the other analysis and said, on the Anderson analysis, I don't see a problem. The plaintiffs are not likely to prevail. What was the district court doing by sort of stepping back from the content-based claim?
You know, Your Honor, I think the district court was making the same mistake that the district court made in Sanders County, which is the court was understandably reluctant to find that a state law is invalid.
Well, but you know, but she said as when I took that, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but as Judge Hawkins was noting, this was a preliminary injunction proceeding where the district court was required to make a pretty quick call on whether or not you were likely to prevail. And she identified the content-based issue, but she said, I think this needs a little bit more development before I'm willing to go there. I mean, she didn't foreclose it by all means.
Correct, Your Honor, but that itself was a legal error because we treat preliminary injunctions in the First Amendment context different, right? As this court explained in Sanders, the burden is initially on the plaintiffs to make a colorable claim of First Amendment infringement, which I think the district court's order says we did. And then the burden was supposed to shift to the state to prove that it was still justified. Had the burden shifted the way it was supposed to, there's actually findings in the district court's order itself that indicate the statute can't survive for a couple reasons. Number one, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I don't think she quite went that far. She was very careful to say this content claim. She acknowledged it and clearly recognized it. She said, but I think that it needs more development before I'm willing to take it on. What was wrong with that under the circumstances?
Because, Your Honor, she misapplied the law that she's supposed to apply when she's looking at a First Amendment claim. First of all, also,
well, she recognized Preet.
Right, she recognized Preet, and she didn't recognize first that it.
This gets back to Judge Rustani's question: Does Reed sort of call into question the footnote in Preet, such that the district judge, should have been on top of it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it absolutely does. I mean, first of all, it lays out the wrong framework. And second, I think it expresses the exact kind of error that the district court was making in Reed. But what I would submit to you is I don't think you have to decide today, and I don't think the district court had to decide, whether every difference between the way that circulators are treated if they're advocating for initiative petitions versus nomination petitions would necessarily always trigger strict scrutiny because there was an alternative here. And that leads to
my next question. However we rule today on the preliminary injunction, the discovery, the dispute will go forward before Judge Bolton, and you'll be able to marshal your proof on burden and other issues, irrespective of the way we rule, correct?
So that's true, but I think there are
Could
a couple
of Could you start with
issues.
A yes or no?
So, yes. The answer is yes. But in the meantime, I think you have a content-based, facially discriminatory law that is going to hurt Arizona petitions, Arizona circulators, Arizona voters this cycle. And I think that's one of the reasons we look at First Amendment preliminary injunctions differently. Second, with a content-based claim, all the evidence the court needed is there on the statute fix and was there in front of the district court to begin with. So if we go back down on the content-based claim, frankly, it's a motion for summary judgment. It's not the evidence, because you don't have to go through the factual burden in the same way.
You might want to be careful about conceding that the record is complete. I see your opposing counsel taking notes. You filed this, your clients filed this litigation in 2014?
No, sorry, my clients filed this litigation shortly after they both, the voters found out that their signatures had been stricken, which is something they were not aware of.
I'm just looking for the date. When did you
file? It was in July of 2019, which was shortly after the initiative.
Can I ask a question about Reed? Before Reed, would you have said this was a content-based statute?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. I think so, because I think if there's actually Reed, I think the Supreme Court would say it was there all along, but I think Reed just makes it incredibly clear. If you can't impose different restrictions on things like directional signs versus political sign, the idea that you can penalize speakers for engaging in a specific kind of communicative conduct and not penalize speakers who engage in...
Okay. Just tell me what case before Reed would have told you this was content-based.
Oh, Your Honor, I may have to come back after. The cases in my head have all kind of run
together.
Okay.
Why don't we hear from the state, and you can think about that, and I'll give you a couple of minutes rebuttal. Okay. We'll hear from the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Drew Ensign on behalf of the intervener state of Arizona. This court's review in this interlocutory appeal is limited and deferential, and the district court did not abuse its discretion for a multitude of reasons. Indeed, by the state's count, there's at least seven grounds that all independently require affirmance here. Before I get to those, I'd like to turn to Judge Rostam's question about what case would have told you that this content-based theory might be available. And Reed specifically relies on Ward versus Rock Against Racism, which is a 1989 case that set forth the idea that hostility to a message can make out a content-based claim. So Reed is nothing new. It's simply a reiteration and application of Ward versus Rock Against Racism. Therefore, Reed is not intervening authority that can be used for a panel to overrule Creed, and Creed remains good law. Turning to the reasons why I think affirmance is required here. First,
Counselor, can you wait just a second?
Yes.
Let's sort of get into the weeds on this. What's the rational basis for distinguishing between initiative petitions and candidate petitions?
Your Honor, there's a multitude of reasons, there's a multitude of laws that do this, and they're based on several reasons. One is that historically there's been greater concern, certainly, about the integrity of the initiative process. We've never had a process where the signature validity was 100% or even close to it. We always have challengers. And in the context of nominating petitions, you can rely on political opponents to act as that check. That's not necessarily the case with initiatives that necessarily have natural enemies that can do so. And there's a multitude of different provisions that kind of reflect this. You know, notably, you want to sign an initiative petition, you actually have to fill out your own information in addition to your signature, and that's so we get more of a handwriting analysis that we can use to compare for forgeries. You know, it just requires many more signatures to get on the ballot for an initiative.
Follow-on question. Don't the people of Arizona and the legislature under the Arizona Constitution stand on equal footing when it comes to proposing legislation?
Yes, Your Honor. The Arizona Constitution absolutely recognizes there are two sources of lawmaking power, both the people themselves and the legislature, and they both have legislative making.
And yet the legislature seems to have made it extraordinarily difficult for initiative petition gatherers as opposed to themselves. There's some litigation going on in our district court right now. As I understand Arizona law, candidates can circulate petitions and sign them online. that can't be done with initiative petitions, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And notably, Preet addresses this specifically. And what Preet says, the argument in Preet, which is exactly the argument here, is that the plaintiff said it was content-based because it, quote, applies only to initiative and referendum petitions, not to recall or candidate sponsorship petitions. That's Preet 438, F3rd at 968. And this court expressly held that was not content-based. What this court said there was that there it was Oregon's Measure 26 that treated initiative and nominating petitions differently. It said, Measure 26 does not regulate what can be said in an initiative or referendum petition, nor does it adopt or reject any particular subject that can be raised in a petition. Therefore, Measure 26 is not a content-based restriction, and strict scrutiny does not apply. I think that's absolutely controlling here, and as we explained earlier, it's still good law.
Do you understand the district court to have really kind of punted on the content-based argument?
A bit, Your Honor, although I think it makes sense given the arguments we've seen as refined on appeal. If plaintiff's argument is that it's content-based because of the hostility of the legislature, you could think that perhaps that's a factual issue that requires factual development, and therefore it should be allowed to go past a motion to dismiss, and instead the district court needs to make a snap judgment as to, you know, the state of the evidence and whether they're likely to prevail. And that's what the district court did. We think that's not an abuse of discretion, although we believe that...
Do you think the footnote in Preet survives Reed?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The principle that they're relying on to overrule Preet is one that was well established at least as far back as Ward versus Rock Against Racism in 1989, and Reed is nothing but a reaffirmation of that principle. It is not an intervening change.
Well, it seems to change it seems to have changed the landscape somewhat. It makes it pretty clear. You know, the sign ordinance had the categories, and that bothered the Supreme Court significantly. And that's kind of what we have here. You have the initiative petitions as well as the candidate petitions, and they're treated differently.
Your Honor, I think that
Reed really exemplifies that distinction. And we used that in the recent case that counsel referred to at the beginning of our argument in the robocall case.
Your Honor,
the categories.
I think that's not controlling here for two reasons.
I understand. I'm just telling you that Reed seems to highlight the notion of if you look at that sign ordinance in Reed, it categorized various kinds of signs and imposed different burdens. And that's kind of what's going on. That's kind of what's going on here, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In one sentence, Reed concludes that this court misapplied the standard and rule of law in Ward. And it's nothing more than a reiteration of the legal standard and an application of the law.
I think the robocall case, I think that's victory.
Victory processing.
Yeah. I think that makes it clear that the content-based test is side-by-side with the Anderson Burdick test. But I was wondering if there's anything in the Supreme Court that says the content-based way of getting to strict scrutiny isn't just, that would lead us to be that it's just part of the Anderson Burdick framework. I'm wondering if there's something out there that tells us there's truly two tests or is there just one test for elections. That's what I want to know.
Your Honor, where it's not a pure regulation of speech, there's only one standard, the Anderson Burdick standard. That's what this court said in Dudum, and in doing so, it specifically relied on the Supreme Court's decision in Anderson to derive that single standard test that this court has applied multiple times, including in the Soltysik case, which I think is highly persuasive here. You know, there, this court refused to allow a viewpoint-based challenge to an electoral regulation and reiterated the single analytical framework of Anderson Burdick applied. And notably, viewpoint discrimination is an even more offensive subset of content-based. And it's undisputed here that the act is viewpoint neutral. Excuse me, Your Honor, my screen went dark.
Yeah, I gave you a softball there. So your argument would be that unless it's viewpoint-based, you're still in the Anderson-Burdick framework, even if it might be called content-based but not viewpoint-based. But you can't do that now because of Victory, right?
No, I believe you can, Your Honor, as long as it's not a pure regulation of speech. Now, Victory obviously involves literal regulation of speech, what you could and could not say. I think this is much more like the Rubin case, which said, which clearly was content-based. It said candidates can discuss their occupation, but not their status on the ballot. But this court said that because it was viewpoint neutral, it did not impose a severe burden under Anderson Burdick, and it never considered whether it was content-based. And this court in Newton looked at Rubin and said, that's further evidence that the single analytical standard of Anderson Burdick governs everything. And I note that Rubin, too, actually literally told candidates what they could and could not say. By contrast here, the act in question, it regulates only conduct, not speech. It regulates whether or not you show up in response to a subpoena as you promised to do. That is not speech, and so a regulation of it cannot be a content-based regulation of speech. Now, we certainly acknowledge that it could burden speech, but that's something that's considered through the Anderson Burdick framework, not through a freestanding content-based claim. You know, fourth, I think it's important to note that plaintiffs have not demonstrated that legal remedies are inadequate here. Indeed, they've expressly disclaimed any requirement they do so, saying that they need not wait to do a motion to quash, ... because it's actually efficient and better in the public interest to have a federal court consider it first. But the requirement of showing that legal remedies are inadequate is fundamental to obtaining any injunctive relief. Nor does this court gratuitously reach constitutional issues simply because plaintiffs suggest it might be efficient to do so.
But what would be the basis for a motion to quash? Failure to serve?
Or it could be that it is too burdensome. Or it could be that the evidence needed is not as relevant as, you know, to justify the burden of showing up. There's innumerable ways. The Arizona law is similar to federal law and makes available almost all of the same grounds that you can move to strike. The Arizona law also creates a cause of action for abusive process that could be used to remedy any abusive process, including subpoenas. We notably raised that in our brief and had there was no response to it in the reply brief. So we think that legal remedies are quite adequate. I mean, I think if you look, for example, to the Leach case, which I believe opposing counsel described as a farce of epic proportions, every single individual motion to quash was granted.
Does this have anything to do with a facial challenge?
I think it certainly does, Your Honor, in that if, in order to prevail on a facial challenge, now it is relaxed because it's First Amendment, but they would have to show that the act has no plainly legitimate sweep. And where the act is used in plainly legitimate ways, then a facial challenge to it necessarily fails. And I think you can see that in the Stanwitz case, for example, which also shows why this act is needed. Even with the act in, you know, the claim by plaintiffs is we don't need the statute in order to make people show up. But in the Stanwitz case, even with the statute in force, all 18 circulators refused to appear. They made almost no effort to even that would allow them to even conceive of the need. And so that's very powerful evidence. The act is not only needed, but if anything, it's insufficient force to actually satisfy the state's ability to get people to show up as they promised to do.
If we were to decide that that this was a violation, a constitutional violation, can you succeed with the other grounds, or are you dead?
No, I think we can, Your Honor. You know, certainly they still have to show irreparable harm. We've cited a number of cases that require them to show irreparable harm. The district court expressly found that the harms were only speculative, and plaintiffs have failed to even argue that factual finding is clearly erroneous. You also have the balance of equities, the final, you know, the third and fourth Winter factors. Notably, the Purcell case tells you that those alone can require denial of a preliminary injunction in election cases. The district courts expressly balanced the equities here, concluded that injunctive relief should not issue, and plaintiffs have not even made an argument that that conclusion was an abuse of discretion.
My question was more along, if we actually were to decide that this was a violation, then wouldn't that really outweigh the other factors or not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Those other factors are independent requirements of injunctive relief, and unless all four winter factors are satisfied, injunctive relief may not issue.
Ninth Circuit doesn't use the sliding scale test?
It does use the sliding scale test. It uses it as a refinement of the winter standard. That has survived so far, but notably, the requirement that irreparable harm be likely has always been a hard floor. That was the core holding of Winter, and it has never been disturbed by this court. You know, two final factors I think are worth highlighting. One, plaintiffs have never meaningfully grappled with the consequences of accepting their arguments. For example, Arizona law requires more signatures to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot than a mere statutory initiative. Under plaintiffs' arguments, that is an illegal content-based restriction of speech. No one's ever thought that, but that is the inescapable conclusion of their argument, which we raised in our answering brief and went unanswered in reply. You know, other things like Arizona, and I believe that my opposing counsel cited the Pest case.
I may have lost sight of the facts in this case. It involves both initiatives and referendums, right?
This case does involve, I believe, initiatives and referenda. The referendum.
Okay. All right.
And so I believe opposing counsel cited the past case. That notably upheld the single subject requirement, I believe, of Nevada law. That is a literal content-based restriction. Now, you may not think it's speech. I think that's, or that you can't bring a claim outside of Anderson verdict. But it's telling people that they can only talk about a single subject and not more than one at a time is a content-based restriction. And so it would necessarily fall if plaintiffs' arguments were accepted. You know, finally, if I could have one final minute.
Yes, or one, make your last point, and then we'll have to move
Thank
on.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's finally, it's worth noting that this court would have to create a square circuit split with the 10th and D.C. circuits reversed. The law at issue in Walker was far more obviously content-based than here. Singling out initiatives regarding wildlife for uniquely disfavored treatment solely based on their content. And the law at issue in Marijuana Policy Project was even worse, clearly being viewpoint-based, allowing those with a viewpoint of increasing marijuana-related penalties access to the ballot while denying access to the ballot with those with the opposite viewpoint. I think this court would have to create a wholly unnecessary circuit split with those courts in order to reverse here. And those courts
okay.
may prefer that affirmance is entirely appropriate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal. We can't hear you. I can't hear you.
No.
We can't hear you. No. Can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Kwame. Yeah, now we can.
Okay.
Now we got you.
This case is about a law that imposes a heightened penalty on a person because they engage in a specific kind of speech. The cases that taught that you cannot use the state power to regulate something like subpoena compliance based on the engagement of the speaker in a certain kind of speech before Reed included RAB from the Supreme Court, ACLU v. Las Vegas, Valle del Sol from this case. It's a mistake to look at Pratt's statement about circulators and initiatives and just look at it as just that statement. The problem here is a disparate penalty on speech that has always been something that triggers strict scrutiny. The plainly legitimate sweep argument doesn't apply to content-based infirmities. This is the point. You can regulate subpoena compliance. You just can't regulate it based on the speaker's communication of a certain kind of conduct. And Pratt, again, you know, the court was very careful there to say they weren't even saying it wasn't a facial invalidation. They were looking at the evidence before them. And what was at issue in Pratt was, frankly, a regulation on the back end. I'm not even sure it was a direct regulation of speech. It simply said you can pay them this way, you can't pay them that way. There was no evidence before the court that actually hurt circulators. And I submit to you, circulators probably got paid more after. Because if you're not getting paid on a signature basis, you have to pay someone more to lure them in. Judge Hawkins, you asked for rational basis reviews. The fraud review is rejected in Buckley. the answer you were given is actually inconsistent with a case the state cites, Libertarian Party v. Husted, which indicates we are more concerned about fraud with nomination petitions because of the quid pro quo danger there with candidates, which just doesn't exist in the initiative context. And with that, Your Honor, I appreciate the court's time. Thank you very much.
And thank you, counsel, very much. We appreciate your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll take a 5-minute recess.